Everyone, I'm very excited to welcome an old friend, Dave Blakely, to Partnership Plus. Dave Blakely is tuning in from San Francisco and has been spending the better part of his entire life convincing organizations how to do design better, how to create new things from internal resources, entrepreneurship that we'll dive into. And Dave, you've always had such remarkable insight on how companies can think differently, how leaders can think differently about this. And I've always valued the insight. So thanks for making the time to join me today.
Yeah, it's a pleasure to be here, Phil.
The company that you are a key part of right now, have been for nearly a decade now, Mach 49, an organization that specializes working with top 1,000 companies around the world to really develop great ventures that can create more value for those organizations. We're not talking about small organizations here. We're talking about really significant, complex, historic organizations with structures, inertia pointing in one direction. I'd love to get to that in a second. But before we do that, what's the Dave Blakely backstory?
Sure. Native Californian, actually. Grew up in Los Angeles, the son of two unassuming humanities high school teachers. And they were very encouraging when I decided I wanted to study engineering, partly because their friends who were engineers had done well for themselves, I think. My quick professional story is I've been part of two different startups. The first was a spinoff of Hewlett-Packard, back when Hewlett-Packard was really in its heyday. That was called Kevex. And the second was an enterprise software company called Bebop. Both of those had grew rapidly. It wasn't easy, but both of them had successful exits. And being part of startups is really what kind of crystallized the way I think about helping big companies to innovate and grow. And between the two startups, I was lucky enough to be one of the founding employees of IDEO, the design and innovation firm, and also one of the folks who helped build the Stanford D School.
I have a number of friends who have engaged through the D School, many stories of just incredible intellect and problem-solving capabilities that go into that. Tell us a bit about the D School.
You know, it's a funny thing, Phil. IDEO, the design and innovation firm, was born partly out of the Stanford product design program. That's an interdisciplinary major. Stanford was way ahead of its time in interdisciplinary majors. And the product design program is a mix of business, art, and mechanical engineering. Mm-hmm. Employees at IDEO took what they had learned in product design, and they really advanced it. And they gave it back to Stanford in the form of the D School. And here's the big idea with the D School. Let's look at how designers think about the world. This doesn't mean that we're going to use design itself to solve problems, like coming up with the physical form of a product or the color of an icon or the placement of a logo, right? This is about the way designers use human inspiration, the possibilities of technology, and the requirements of business to visualize holistic solutions to really hard problems. So when IDEO helped create the D School, and David Kelly, IDEO's chairman, created it, we asked ourselves, how can you take the way designers think? Take some of the design-intensive industries like advertising and industrial design, abstract their mental constructs, the way they solve problems and think about the world, and reapply those in a way that's relevant to all the people that come to the D School. And that includes governments, financial services companies, pharmaceutical companies, every type of organization, academic and government and business, from every vertical market you can think of, from every corner of the world, they've all been intrigued enough with design thinking to come to the D School at some point. It's been really rewarding to see.
I have no doubt. And in the company which I co-founded most recently, Dropbuy Health, we have a head of design and experience. Her name's Monica Jordan, and she comes from a very deep design background, and she has led incredible swathes of activity and work to help us refine the way we think about bringing products to market, the way we communicate, the way that we not just bring a palette of colors to a product and the physical interaction with what goes on, but actually all the depth of how we should be imagining what an experience and what the feeling should be like for someone that uses a product. And, you know, the ability for somebody who has that very native sensibility to be a core part of an organization is so important. And I think, you know, we first met when we were connected by a mutual friend, Ofer Yom Tov, who has gone on to lead design for ANZ Bank and now has started a new venture that is focused on design and bringing that to life as well. When you think about trying to introduce design into a very large organization, I guess this tips into the Mach 49 conversation.
Sure.
why was Mach49 created, and what, sure, how is it different to what was happening at IDEO?
What got me so extremely excited about Mach49 and the reason that led me to join the company in very, very early stages was it made me think of IDEO in its finest hour. We can honestly say that IDEO and design thinking for many organizations, it really changed the way they went about their day, right? It changed the way they innovate. IDEO took lessons from designers, but the message was, you don't need to be a designer to employ design thinking. Mm. Mach49 has what I like to believe is an even bigger idea with even more impact on the global business community. At Mach49, we say, let's take the lessons learned from unicorn startups and from world-class venture capitalists. Let's distill those and extract those, and then let's reapply those in huge organizations, mostly global 1,000 businesses, but also huge government agencies, in order to propel forward growth and innovation. And that's been a really exciting ride over the last 10 years.
Oh, look, I can only imagine. And I look at this from afar. I mean, the idea of Mach49, I think if I got this right, Mach49 is escape velocity in terms of speed. Yes. This is this notion of getting outside the Earth's atmosphere. The name is not lost on me. I love it.
You get it. Well done.
So when it comes to that kind of inertia, I mean, the energy, yeah, when we think about watching a SpaceX launch or even a shuttle launch, the amount of energy that's needed to get a very large, seemingly inanimate object off the ground into space to do the thing it needs to do is, I guess, the perfect analogy for what tends to need to happen in large organizations. And yes, my hunch here is that the ability for you to come in as a trusted partner to collapse the time to trust so that relationships can be formed, that takes an enormous amount of inertia and energy to make that change. And I imagine there's a very strong partnership-driven approach that you apply to not only pitching new business, but also then doing the hard yards to do the years of work to create the outcome. Can we talk a little bit about what it takes for an organization like yours to be part of the furniture at a large client organization of yours? Because we're here really about partnerships. And for most people, it feels very, very foreign about how you would go about doing that. But obviously it takes an enormous amount of trust. We've known each other for a long time. I see that in every conversation we have. It feels like a 101 table stakes for you. How does that work from a partnership's point, sure, of view as you try to convince an organization you can help them move the needle?
Look, there are some things that are table stakes in any sort of partnership. And then there are stretch goals that anyone who aspires to be a good partner should reach for. Mm. Yeah. An example of table stakes, to your point, is in order to use the Mach49 metaphor, in order to get a massive craft out of the Earth's gravitational well, it takes a huge amount of energy. And also, you have to demonstrate that you know what you're doing. Mm. So, you know, table stakes, initial approval, if we're going to partner with, if we're proposing a partnership with a new client to create, build, and launch a new venture, sort of table stakes is, do we have a really good digital repository of all of our information for them to use in an ongoing business? Yes, we do. Can we demonstrate that we have successfully created, built, and launched organizations with other large global 1,000 transnationals that are doing well and have sort of double growth rates on a semi-annual basis? We sure do. So those are just basic capabilities that any good organization should demand. And then beyond that, for any kind of partner, I really think that people look for three things. I make heavy use of partners. I've made heavy use of partners my whole career. Now we're working with people that are considering us true partners. Mm-hmm. So the first thing I want to say is true partnership means what I like to call shared generative activity. It's hard to figure out where the ideas or where the concept came from when you look back at the end. If that's the mode, then you've elevated a vendor to a true partner. Mm. And I think, you know, thinking about partnerships, Phil, I think what we're looking at here is organizations that have unique and complementary capabilities. We know how to create new lines of business, unicorn startup style. One of our clients might be world-class in pharma. Those, I think you'd agree, those are good complementary skill sets. Also, think about the appetite. we're never going to go into the line of business that our clients are in. We're not going to become, we're not going to become electric component manufacturers like our client TDK. And similarly, they're typically not going to create from scratch all these tools for growth that we show them, though they are very interested in our promise to build capability, not dependence. And the final thing I'll say is in a true partnership, you don't have issues with equity ownership, which so often cloud the relationship. Our content, our methods, our tools, our know-how, that belongs to us, and we're using it to liberate new ideas for new line of businesses, which belong entirely to our clients. Seems like a trivial little point, but issues of equity and intellectual property ownership are often really central to a successful partnership.
Dave, in your very expansive career, are there some partnerships which just stand out to you as being absolutely game-changing, perhaps for a perspective you developed as a consequence of that partnership, or even ones that have not worked well, and on reflection you go, aha, I know why that didn't work, and I wish I could have my time again. Of course, I'm sure you fold those learnings straight into what comes next. But are there a couple of examples you can talk to that really stand in your mind where the partnership worked extremely well and it just created a new insight for you?
I think the first thing I want to say is something I only realized later is the best partnerships came from choosing a partnership for the right reason, right? Mm-hmm. If it makes sense to hold a new initiative, a new product introduction, the development of a new service entirely inside your walls, whether it's a new venture or just an incremental product release, that's not a good partnership. If it's an extremely high risk program, then sometimes it makes much more sense to say make a venture investment in a startup to advance that initiative than a partnership. So what characterizes a good partnership, again, is this shared idea generation and, you know, authentic, a lot of people give lip service to this, but authentically raising a vendor to the level of a true partner and working on honest co-creation. I'm lucky enough to have been through a lot of these. In some of the very first programs I did for Apple Computer when I was brand new at IDEO, and yes, it was terrifying to work for Apple Computer. We were developing, and this kind of shows my age, we're developing some of their first, some of the accessories around their first lines of notebook computers, which were called the PowerBooks. And Apple's vision was so expansive and the work was so difficult and the timelines were so tight that we couldn't have done, we never could have gotten our product, which was called the DuoDoc, which was my team's program. We never could have gotten that to market successfully without a lot of carefully chosen partners. And in every case, the co-creation activity was really central. When we were designing these immensely complicated plastic parts made through a manufacturing process called injection molding, it wasn't about using a vendor and saying, okay, make exactly this. It was about bringing an injection molder in during the earliest stages and co-designing the parts with them, for example. I can point to shared generative activities all through my career. Another one that might interest you is I was in Africa working with Standard Bank, which is the largest lender by assets in sub-Saharan Africa. Wonderful organization. And their goal was to become an engine for upward social and economic mobility for everyone in sub-Saharan Africa. One of the programs had to do with consumer packaged goods moving across the African continent. Well, what's fundamental in building a new line of business is an honest and empathetic appreciation for all your stakeholders. I was in Kenya. I was in Nigeria. I needed to get to importers and manufacturers and distributors and wholesalers and small retailers. How are you going to do that? Yeah. I started with a vendor relationship with a woman named Hilda Ogeto, this wonderful vendor who quickly became a partner in Kenya, and another named Jennifer Iwuze in Nigeria. There is no way I could have gathered the insights that were required to build that new line of business if I had if I had done an arm's length vendor relationship and said to people, you know, find me these types of people based on the following specification, goodbye, no way. You bring them in. You bring them in on the synthesis where you're interpreting what you're learning and finding direction. You bring them in to work together on the recruiting spec. You bring them together to brainstorm the type of people you want to talk to and the industries you want to talk to. That's a true partner. And I cannot tell you how much the ultimate success of the Standard Bank program relates to these tight, true partnerships that I had working with people like Hilda and Jennifer. And I've been lucky enough to work with Hilda's and with Jennifer's my whole career all over the world. It's just been fantastic.
A comment before about not being a consultant, but being somebody who can transfer that knowledge so that it becomes a capability inside these organizations.
Yes.
I imagine that becomes a tricky thing to have happen when there might be a organizational change or a shift in priorities or there's a shift somewhere that happens in an organization where maybe the priority for that becomes less important, still relevant, still important to the long term, but for whatever reason, there's a change.
Yeah.
This is deviating a little bit, but how would you recommend people think about this idea of trying to install capability as opposed to jumping on a gravy train where the consultant is always around because the dependency is created? You know, obviously there's a need to try and make the organizational self-sufficient.
Yeah.
How do you think about that kind of transfer? Because that is not often an easy one, because the expertise and the thing that is brilliant about someone like, or the group like Mach 49, is they live and breathe this every single day, and it's a magnetic kind of attraction, right? There is so much goodness that you can see. How do you transfer that in to make it part of the furniture at a large organization like the ones you work with? A
couple of thoughts for our listeners who are struggling with this right now. The first thing is, be very judicious and very surgical in terms of the new capabilities and the new skills that you choose to bring in-house, because it's a big commitment. You should bring in consultants. You should outsource a great deal of the work that you do to consultants. You should probably outsource your tax and regulatory work to consultants. You know, you should outsource, for example, some of the decisions on divesting or acquiring new businesses to highly skilled investment banks. But we believe that the art of growth, the art of organic and inorganic growth, is so central to an organization that you shouldn't trust it to be outsourced. You should benefit from design consultants and business consultants who can help you with growth. But we believe that organizations should recognize that venture-driven growth is not some sort of innate talent that only whacked-out people with piercings in Silicon Valley can do and tat it up, right? Venture-driven growth is a learnable set of skills, not an innate talent. Now, it happens to be a very diverse set of skills, from very qualitative areas like maintaining team morale and managing the mothership while you're working on a venture, all the way to highly quantitative skills like measuring total addressable market or creating a quantitative revenue plan. But our listeners should know that these are entirely learnable skills. Now, the particular initiatives may not persist. We've had a couple different programs, one with a big energy giant called RWE and one with Schneider Electric, if you're familiar with them, where we built a new line of business. It was doing well. It was thriving. And they spun it off at a very attractive multiple because the strategic direction the company was going did not align perfectly with the direction the startup took. That happens. That's okay. But here's the important thing. The skills, right? If you break down venture-driven growth into its component skills, those stay with a company. And those can continue to be applied to any initiative. And beyond just new venture creation within a company, they can be applied to internal programs. Heck, we have people right now applying venture-driven growth methods to human resource challenges.
Dave, when we last caught up, you mentioned some of the government work and the clients that you were doing there. Often people will look at government and feel that they often don't move quick enough. Sadly, government is usually the place where the toughest problems are left to be solved. You know, when you're trying to think about maybe the point of view you bring to a listed organization versus a government. Is there a difference in the thinking that you provide to those two types of organizations, or is there actually a very common bridge between both to help them move the needle in whatever their objectives are?
There is absolutely a commonality. Look, if you think about methods for growth and innovation, if you think about the big five perspectives, they apply equally well inside government and in the private sector, though they can be, frankly, much more difficult to apply in government for reasons we can get to in a minute. Sure. But in general, Phil, design thinking, agile development, lean manufacturing, open innovation, disruptive innovation. These are the big five overlapping perspectives, which break down into a set of methods and tools that, you know, you and I have talked about in the past, yeah, such as the customer representative and the sprint from agile, you know, the empathetic user research from design thinking, and so on. I have never worked with a government agency from the IRS to the Navy, to the state's insurance fund for the state of California, that didn't see the benefit of those methods and couldn't apply them in some appropriate way. The challenge is it's incumbent on the extended team, the Mach 49 team plus the government group, to work within both business and even more than business, policy viability, right?
Right.
You're kidding yourself if you come up with ideas that are completely outside or prohibited by government policy, because they're not going to move forward. But here's the good news. Innovation loves constraints. There's this myth about the green field of innovation where the best thing is to brainstorm without any constraints. That's bunk. That's garbage. If anybody believes that, they need to reject it. The fact is, innovation loves constraints. Some of the most constrained cultures, developing countries with constraints around resources and intellectual capital, you know, and access to money and so on, those are also some of the most resourceful and some of the most innovative. So as long as government innovation programs are well run with an understanding of regulation and an attitude not of here's why you can't do that, but an attitude of here's what it'll take. What will it take to work successfully from within these regulations? Boy, we've had great success working with government agencies.
Yeah, so let's just double click on that for a minute, because there's something interesting about how you recruit on the partner side the people that can help lead this effort in addition to their day jobs.
Absolutely.
So, you know, often the best talent is going to be very busy because they've been identified as talent. They're already loaded to the hilt with probably two jobs, not just even one job. How have you found it to both identify and then encourage and then create the playing field space for them to have the mind share, or to borrow their mind share to come and be part of this? So not only they can inform what's going on, but also then recruit their own teams to help move the needle on that piece. Because I imagine that's a linchpin moment for any starting point of a new relationship, whether it be in government or elsewhere.
Yeah. It's a very astute question, because that is absolutely one of our biggest challenges. We can teach people to be innovative, to be creative. We can teach people to generate fantastic new venture ideas. What we can't teach people is to have that fundamental hunger and self-discipline, which is what we look for. And so the irony is the people, well, it's what you would expect, I guess. The people who are the most perfectly suited to be part of what we call the new venture team within large corporations, which we assemble, a 3 to 5 person new venture team, and also the new venture board, they're also the hardest to grab.
Yeah.
And this is an area for all the work we do that is bottom up, where you're creating a team and you're using inductive logic to come up with ideas from the bottom. One thing that's got to be tops down for the most part is we need a CEO or other C-level executive mandate to managers to free up some of their most valuable employees to be members of a new venture team. And it's absolutely wrenching, for good reason, for these managers, because the kinds of people that we need are first-class delivery people and first-class operators, and they make themselves absolutely essential to whatever product line they're part of. And, you know, you need that CEO mandate. Otherwise, the person's boss, reasonably enough, says, you're not getting this person. Forget it. Are you crazy? I couldn't live without him. Those are the people that we need. But here's a dirty little secret. If we don't give them these types of opportunities, eventually, they'll be out the door.
Yeah.
So the company owes it to itself to supply these venture creation opportunities to these really, this real top flight talent within the organization.
And that's a real paradox, isn't it? Because that ability for a CEO to allocate talent and sort of to give that opportunity is, like you say, critical for them to stay around, to feel engaged, to grow. But then how do you get the rest of the work done? Yes. Let's sort of continue down that thread a little bit, because I imagine the average duration and tenure of one of your engagements through Muck 49 is quite a substantial amount of time. Have you seen a standard, if you run a standard curve over the top of your engagement lengths, is there a standard time for the kind of venture creation to take effect in your client organizations, or is it really completely individualistic when it comes to the type of industry, the type of organization, whether it's public or private?
Look, it varies hugely, but we do everything. You're asking a good question. Let me give you some numbers, because we do everything possible to match pace with unicorn-style startups that might be funded by tier one venture capitalists. And so many of the programs we run, if governance is properly lifted and if the teams are given the freedom and the resources they require for digital programs, for pure digital programs, which by its nature is faster, we're talking in many cases about pilot customers within 18 to 24 months. So right. Both of the cases I mentioned earlier, the a program called EIQ for Schneider Electric and a program called Pear.ai for RWE, 18, 19, 20 months in, they had their pilot customers, like what right. you would expect from a really solid pure digital startup in, you know, Silicon Valley or Sydney or anywhere else with a lot of concentration of innovation and creative class. Now, when you get into hard tech, when you get into complex electromechanical systems in a domain like oil and gas or mining or autonomous vehicles, now we're often talking more like 3 to 5 years, sure. Just because hardware takes patience. Mm-hmm. But I would argue also hardware can provide that fantastic competitive advantage once you've perfected it.
I definitely agree. And look, we're having this conversation in April of 2024. I think most people would argue the world's not in great shape right now. There's a lot of tension happening in different places geopolitically. I think we've still got a COVID hangover that people are trying to not acknowledge. And as I've said recently, I feel as though, you know, there have been dog years added to our leadership lives in terms of what we've had to try and move through to make our team safe, to make sure that we can keep functioning the way we need to function. How is that playing out in the world of venture-driven growth? Because, you know, cross-border partnership, organizations working in different geographies with different cultures, different operating models, there is complexity here, but it's not as though this complexity didn't exist before. But there seems to be a layer of, I'll call it just general anxiety, I guess, that's happening around the world right now. How are you seeing that play out? And you've always been very optimistic with me, so I imagine your viewpoint remains optimistic. But what are you seeing in the clients at the moment as they're trying to grapple with both, you know, the war for talent, trying to inspire and keep people safe and motivated and engaged? How are you seeing that in your clients?
I would say, Phil, we're really seeing two things that are affected by two of the most challenging situations in the world today. In terms of how they affect our business, I believe really that what is often referred to as the China plus one business strategy is, sure, it's getting some press, but I think it's an underreported business news story in terms of the ultimate impact it will have. The big idea of China plus one is that China for years has been the manufacturing center and the manufacturing contractor. You know, people like Foxconn and Selectron and so on have been the manufacturing contractors for, consumer products and many industrial products for companies all over the world, but especially from Western European and US companies. Now that's changing. Companies are keeping their manufacturing lines in China in place. And they're maintaining those relationships, but they're adding them. They're adding them in India, they're adding them in Southeast Asia, and they're adding them in Mexico. And again, an underreported news story was the Apple 14, the iPhone 14. Apple set up a parallel manufacturing line to its manufacturing line in China in India. India delivered iPhone 14 products ahead of schedule, exceeding Apple's quality standards, which are incredibly rigorous. And that's a big story, in my opinion. So the move towards away from global supply chain, the realization that supply chains are more brittle than anybody imagined, as we all discovered during COVID, and also the move towards more regional supply chain means, for example, that the U.S. did more trade with Mexico than with China in the last few months. That is a trend that I think is not going to reverse, is not going to change, and will only accelerate the regionalization of supply chains and the pullback. That affects all of us. It is certainly affecting us at Mach 49. It is a manifestation in part of global geopolitical tensions. And, you know, the other thing that is, it's mundane, but it's an enormous issue, is money was cheap for a lot of years, Phil, and now money's expensive. Interest rates are way, way up. And that really changes the calculus of some of the big bets that companies are making.
When you think about partnerships and all the potential that lives inside that, you know, every company I've ever built, you know, we couldn't afford the marketing spend that many of our other competitors had. We had to find ways to do partnerships in two different ways. One was around how we do growth and go to market. The other one was how we turn, as you say, our vendors or our suppliers into true partners that actually gave us a force multiplier around the rate and pace at which we could innovate as a small company with really limited resource. What are leaders who are not seeing this opportunity for partnership missing?
Leaders of global 1,000 companies are hesitant to partner. They're hesitant to create cohorts with other organizations. They're hesitant to create joint ventures. They're hesitant to create new partnerships. And they're hesitant for understandable but really lousy reasons. It's because partnerships are risky and vendor relationships are safe, and vendor relationships are what everybody does, right? Look, it's understandable. If you're a leader in a global 1,000 company, people often use, you know, sort of the super tanker at sea as an analog of a global 1,000 company. One of my collaborators, Dror Sharon, over at Intel, he's an entrepreneur in residence. He uses a bullet train, which I think is a more apt analogy. The track has already been laid. There is only one route. And the job of the executives, to a great extent, is to keep that massive, complex, high-speed, high-momentum bullet train moving forward as predictably and reliably as possible. Well, of course, the risks, you know, they have a fiduciary responsibility to their shareholders. Of course, the risks in a joint venture. Of course, the risks in truly doing shared generative activities with an external partner are going to appear difficult and are going to be rejected in favor of a conventional vendor relationship where you somehow fancy yourself able to specify every possible thing you need built. I want to urge any of the leaders listening to this to open the door and to seriously consider the fact that the inherent risk in more intimate business partnerships as opposed to vendor relationships, that risk is hugely outweighed by the potential benefits of the true co-creation that happens in partnerships. I've seen it over and over and over where two, three, or even four different partners, each with something really exciting to share, does something that they never could have come up with in a more conventional business arrangement.
So Dave, I'm looking forward to our conversations being more regular because there is so much more for us to be talking about. But I'd like to close out this fantastic conversation with a more personal question, which is really for a younger group of leaders and managers and entrepreneurs who are listening and watching this, around what the advice you would give to your 20-year-old self, given the extraordinary amount of organizations and impact you've had personally on me and many, many, many thousands of people. You're 20 years old. What are you encouraging yourself to do now based on what you have lived so far in your life?
Hey, 20-year-old Dave, give greater weight and get better at listening to that inner voice and that inner guide inside you. Stop subordinating a lot of the decisions that you make to things that, you know your parents want to do, and you know that they will be proud of you if you do, or things that seem like the conventional way to go forward in a business career, in a student career, or things that you're sort of pushed to do by your peer group. Your internal voice is not infallible. Don't believe anybody who tells you their inner compass is infallible, but failure to listen to my own internal guide has been responsible for many of the wrong turns and decisions of things I would have done differently in my life. And in retrospect, I wish I had gotten better at listening to that internal voice younger.
I totally hear you. And I think I would echo that advice. Yeah. Dave Blakely, where can people learn more about Mach 49, its programs, its capability and expertise? Where should people go and visit to learn more about that?
I want to encourage people to go to one thing about having a weird company name is there's only one of us on the web. I want to encourage everyone to go to Mach49.com, MACH49.com. And within Mach 49, if you're curious what I do for a living, within the Mach 49 website, go to the Mach 49 Growth Institute. And it'll show you what occupies all my waking moments and some of my sleeping moments.
That's fantastic. Dave, thank you for making the time to join me today.
It's a real pleasure.
A pleasure as always. And I look forward to many people visiting that website and also reaching out to you so that they can learn more about how Mach 49 does what it does so well.
I'm always game for a good conversation. I'm looking forward to more of ours, Phil.